the nations assembled and the preparation of the elements for the great fire of God's indignation. That's the title of the chapter in the fourth volume. So it's not just going to be hopefully some edifying thoughts this morning, but a great bedtime story for the kids. And so when you look at this chapter, let's talk about just for a second, why would we discuss this chapter? Why would we pick this topic? And there's a few different reasons. One is this is the beginning stage of the times that we're living in. In 2 Peter 3:10, it says, "And the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements will be destroyed with a fervent heat, and the earth and its works that are therein shall be burned up." And so anything we can do to understand the times that we're living in, I think, is times well spent. And the other reason is we want to be able to understand sin when we see it. When we see the world the way that it is, it's so important that we take a look at what's going on and we take the roots of some of these problems and we understand them, because in the kingdom, it'll be our responsibility to help the world overcome some of these problems. And so let's remember that in Hebrews 5:14, this is one of my favorite scriptures, it says solid food, or as we know it better, strong meat, is for those who have their powers of discernment trained by constant practice to distinguish good from evil. So hopefully the discourse this morning will help us a little bit in those regards. And we obviously want to understand the fourth volume contents. I'll tell you, a couple of years ago, I was listening to a panel, and Brother Larry McClellan mentioned during the panel, he said, you know, maybe every now and then we should open the fourth volume. I don't know of a lot of fourth volume studies going on. And I said, you're right. Larry McClellan, you're right. We need to look in the fourth volume. So if you like these thoughts, please let me know. And if you don't, it's all Larry's fault. We also want to understand, like I said, the times that we're living in, and we want to understand sin when we see it. And so just a few things about this chapter and about the fourth volume. The fourth volume is 14 studies or chapters for about 650 pages. It averages about 46 pages per study. But this chapter is 115 pages long. And I wanted to point that out because I did not realize this. It accounts for only 7% of the chapters, but almost 18% of the book. And at 115 pages, this is the longest chapter of any chapter in any of the volumes. It is number one. So Brother Russell spent more time and research into this chapter than any other. And I found that really interesting too. The second longest chapter is also in the fourth volume. I think it's the one right before it. And one thing that we want to prime our minds for is, you know, as we're living in the day that we're living in, and this goes probably for any of the brethren who've ever lived, and that is that tradition, what we see around us, is not always right, is it? Just because people have been doing things for a certain way for a certain period of time, it doesn't mean they're doing it the right way. And a great example we learn about is in Jehu, when he does everything God commanded. He takes out the Baals from Israel. He takes out the line of Ahab. But it says after that, he took no heed to walk in the law of the Lord. And so you wonder, if he was so faithful in what God told him to do, why was he unfaithful in the end? And it's not just him. 23 kings for approximately 237 years, made the same mistake. They had golden calves. Now, I didn't realize that until I reread this story a couple of years ago, but I mean, come on, if you're Jewish, don't you know that golden calves is not so great? But for almost 240 years, they had golden calves for people to worship in the north part of Israel. So what we learned from that, by going and reading king after king after king, he didn't depart from the ways of Jeroboam. He didn't depart from the ways of Jeroboam. And everybody was fooled for 240 years. Let's remember that it might be easier to be misled than we realize sometimes. And God will not always point out exactly what it is we need to do. So it's our responsibility to know the scriptures to the best of our ability and understand God's ways. So I thought I would point that out before we dive into these things, because again, we want to make sure that as we're looking at the world events, we see them in the right light. Brother Russell is essentially taking this chapter to talk about the building up of frustration in the world. And so The main subject headings in this chapter is the gathering of the nations and the rich versus the poor. He spends a lot of time on that. He talks about labor. He talks about foreign industrial competition. He talks about the giants in those days. And he talks about this is all beyond the power human to regulate, the human power to regulate it. So in the Assembly of the Nations, just to take a quick minute and make sure we understand that right, he says that we are brought together, not physically, but through transportation, through communication. Any one of us right now can pick up our phones and call somebody in India. That is awesome. But that's not how it was over 150 years ago, was it? So we're brought together in a lot of different ways. In Zephaniah chapter 3, verses 8 and 9, says, therefore, wait upon me, says the Lord, until the day I rise up for the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation. And I love this next line. It says, even all my fierce anger, for the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. And let's take just a second to note that word jealousy. What does that mean? It means that God wants the world for himself. That's what it means. He wants the world for himself. And so he's going to destroy the systems that are keeping the world from him. And this is a great witnessing scripture, because if you believe in hell and you're in mainstream Christianity, you read this and say, oh yeah, he's coming, he's going to get you. But what does the next verse say in verse 9? Then, after the fire and destruction, then I will turn to the people of pure language, that they all may call upon the name of the Lord and serve him with one consent. And I think that's really beautiful. The Lord assures us this is a short work. He says this in Romans 8:29. And Brother Russell writes in reprint 576, he's comparing in Isaiah 24 that a farmer will not continue to plow. There's a purpose to it. He first prepares the soil of humanity and breaks it up and makes it ready for the seed of truth. Then follows the sowing of seed and the harvest in each its season. So the work of the Lord during this period is to turn over the soil. It's to make the conditions right, to plant seeds, to build up, and bring mankind into a state of mind and heart where they are ready to accept his commandments. So as we see these things happening, know that's the work that's being done. It's not death and destruction in the world. It's a preparation work for the world to be ready to receive the kingdom. So he writes on page 272, looking about us, we see the elements preparing for the fire of this day, the fire of God's wrath, selfishness, knowledge, wealth, ambition, hope, discontent, fear, despair. These are the ingredients that whose friction will shortly set aflame the angry passions of the world and cause its various social elements to melt in the fervent heat. And then he mentions all are dissatisfied. It doesn't matter what part of the world you're in. If you're rich, if you're poor, you're male or you're female, you're educated or you're ignorant, everybody seems to be dissatisfied. And he says something that is so true of our day. He says, all are selfishly and increasingly grasping for rights or bemoaning wrongs. And he says, yes, absolutely, there are some rights that need to be fixed, and there are some wrongs that are terrible. But the tendency of our time, with the increase of knowledge and independence, is to only look at the side of questions that are closest to self-interest and fail to appreciate the opposite side. And I think we see that in the world today. We even see it sometimes among ourselves. We can't fail to appreciate the other side. The more we just take one side and pound it in over and over again, the more we separate ourselves. And that in some ways is a good thing, and that some ways if overdone can be a negative thing. Zechariah 14:13 says that the result of this work is that the hand shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor. Every man's hand shall rise against the hand of his neighbor. And the effect foretold by the prophets will ultimately be to set every man's hand against his neighbor, which will be the immediate cause of the great final catastrophe. And here he segments into one of the biggest sections in this chapter, the rich versus the poor. while the rich are diligently heaping up fabulous treasure for these last days, tearing down their storehouses to build bigger ones. They're saying to themselves and their posterity, you know, you've got so much. You've got stuff laid up for so many years. Eat, drink, and be merry. And God, through the prophets, is saying, that is foolish, because your soul, your life, is required of you today. And so we know that the way things should be, I love these scriptures in Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 5. Do nothing from selfish ambition. In humility, count others being more significant than yourself. Don't look just to your own interests. Look to the interests of other people. Have this mind in you that also was in Christ Jesus. And that's the mind that we should have as we go through these times, or any time. And also to remember that as we see people make mistakes in the world, as we see people make mistakes in our own fellowship, hate the sin, but love the sinner. Remember that God so loved the world that he sent his son while the world was full of sin. So, Brother Russell starts this heaping of treasures. He says it's impossible for a man with a good heart to be satisfied with the world as it now is. No one can truly enjoy even what he earns, what he knows to be his, knowing that millions of his fellow men are in misery and want. That's on page 435. It's in the next chapter, but that really grabbed my attention. He says, it's evident that we are in a time preeminent above all others for the accumulation of wealth and for the wanton or extravagant living on the part of the wealthy. There are, he quotes a gentleman named Gladstone, and I don't know who Gladstone is, but what he says is, and keep in mind, this is in the 1890s. There are gentlemen before me who have witnessed a greater accumulation of wealth within their period of their lives than has been seen in all the preceding years since Julius Caesar. I think we're used to it, right? This is 2023, 1870, 1880, 1890. This was kind of new. And so when you look at this, again, we're not spending a whole lot of time on these, but Waldorf Astor, Rockefeller, Jay Gould, Vanderbilt Sr., Vanderbilt Jr. This purple number is the amount of thousands of dollars they were making per day. Now, if you make $20,000 a month today, you're doing pretty well. You're pretty comfortable. You're probably pretty grateful. I wouldn't mind making that myself. But this is what they were making per day in 1897. So think about that. That small teal bar is how many millions they made per year. And so people are looking around saying, wow, there's so much wealth. And we come to James 5:1. And I have to be honest with you, I really struggled with the scripture for a while, because it says, come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. And the question is, so is it just being rich? Is that what's so sinful? It's just, if you come up with a good idea and you work really hard, like, is it really sinful? And I don't know that it is. But as we dive in here, I want to understand how God looks at it. I want to understand why it's worded this way, why it seems so harsh and condemning. And so we get a little bit of glimpse as to how this is sinful in Psalm 73:3. Asaph writes this psalm, and he says, you know, I was really distraught. In fact, I was almost stumbling because I was so upset. I was so envious of the arrogant when I saw, and I think this is the key phrase, the prosperity of the wicked. And so that tells us that if you're earning an income through immoral means or ungodly means, that's the sin. The sin lies in how it was made. And so if you look at verse 4, it says, behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your field that you kept back by fraud are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. So what I'm taking away from this is, one, maybe you made your income illegally. We've seen that. Maybe you've shamelessly taken from those who have so little. And you've taken it for yourself because you could, because it was legal. And so you yourself become wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And that's wrong. But I think the main one that we see today is this third one. while you've been getting wealthy, the very people that are working for you are barely getting by. And you're getting richer and richer and richer. But the people who are doing the work to make you rich, they themselves are wondering, am I going to be able to make my rent payment next month? And we see that in today's world where, you know, again, the pay for the field level has gone up a little, right? It's gone up, maybe gone up 150% since the year 2000. CEO pay has gone up 500%. And so the people that need it the least are the ones getting it the most. And we see that. And I think that is something the Lord is calling out, saying, you folks are going to have something to be concerned about later. The kingdom is going to be more difficult for you than it's going to be for people who have nothing but a kind heart and are ready to accept the message. How they got their millions, I want to tell just a quick story, because, you know, we look at Vanderbilt and Rockefeller and Carnegie, and Brother Russell spends 20 pages going through their wealth and how they made their money, and I don't want to go through the belabored effort that he went through. So if you're interested in that and you want to read the details of it, it's there in the fourth volume. But for this purpose, I just want to tell one story as to how they got rich and what their mentality was like. So Vanderbilt, obviously he owned a lot of railroads, if you're familiar with him, and he had a family fortune of $254 million in 1897. That's not shabby. I think if you were to convert that into today's money, that would be a lot. Rockefeller, he ran Standard Oil. His estimated wealth at his death was $1.4 billion. That was in the 1930s. Again, not doing too shabby. And Carnegie owned Carnegie Steel, which later turned into U.S. Steel. And he had an estimated wealth, also not bad, $475 million. So, here's the story. Here's the story not just of how they made their money, but how it impacted others in their day and age. And I didn't realize this when I started this study. But after studying economics in the 1870s, because there was a Great Depression in the 1870s, I was curious if this had anything to do with it, and it does. So in 1871, they started this Southern Improvement Company. Rockefeller owned 40% of all the shipments going around in trains. He accumulated 40% of all the shipments. That's how well he was doing, but it wasn't good enough. So he and Vanderbilt and this gentleman named Tom Scott, and Tom Scott and Vanderbilt had the majority of the railroads. They said, let's just keep the money between us. And so what they did is they had special discounts going to Rockefeller, and not just that he got a special discount, anybody who wasn't under Rockefeller's umbrella got a higher price. Isn't that fun? So we see in 1872, it's about 6 months later, we see this what's called the Cleveland Massacre. It's not a literal massacre, but Rockefeller goes to Cleveland. There were 26 competing refineries there, and he bought 22 of them in 6 weeks. How does that happen? Especially because they were not happy about it. And this is the portion of the discourse where we understand the sin. Rockefeller was already doing well. He goes to these companies. He says, you got two options. You can come under my umbrella, the Standard Oil umbrella, and your business will survive, but I'll make most of the money. Or you can go out of business because I'm partnering with the railroads, and we're going to jack up your railroad prices so big, you won't be able to make a profit. Right? Now, that's how he got so wealthy. The refineries would divide their shipments among the three railroads and agreed upon a percentage in exchange for highly discounted rates. The discounted rates were funded by a highly inflated price to non-participating refineries. In an unprecedented design, the participating refiners would receive rebates from their own shipments and also receive a percentage of the higher prices paid by the non-participating refineries. So think about that. Not only did the people who had the least get a higher price, Rockefeller got a portion of that price. And so it doesn't surprise us to know that by 1879, he owned 90% of all the refineries in the entire United States. So here's how it affected the public. In 1873, there was a depression. It was bad. It was on par with the Great Depression in the 1930s that we're very familiar about. The European market crashed, affecting U.S. investments, specifically, lo and behold, railroads. You see, by this point, all the other railroad companies, they didn't have enough capital to be profitable. And so the people got scared, and they ran and they took their money out of the bank. And this one bank, named the Jay Cooke Bank, was the first one to fall. It had the majority of its investments in smaller railroads. So 89 of the country's 364 railroads crashed into bankruptcy. 18,000 businesses failed over the next 2 years. Men were no longer able to provide for their families. It set up a perfect recipe for employers to take advantage. They could hire whoever they wanted at whatever wage they wanted. The people had no choice. Unemployment went up to 14%. Rutherford B. Hayes, the president at the time, had to send in federal troops to more than half a dozen states to stop the fighting that erupted from all of the panic, from all of the fear. Over 100 people were killed as a result of these fights. And so all this starts, and you just wonder if this one man, in order to get so wealthy, had a big hand in causing all this. Is that a sin? I think James chapter 5 applies directly to people who would do that. And so when we see these things, and again, they called it a panic. If you look it up in history, they didn't call it a depression. They called it a panic. Why would they call it a panic? Well, because panic puts the blame on the people, not the companies. Well, see, the problem happened because everybody went and took their money out of the bank. It's not us. It's them. It's just a panic. They just got scared and did the wrong thing. That's the problem. So they had most of the money. How can the rest of the industry have enough when so much is in the hands of so few? And so this is the message of Cain. I'm not my brother's keeper. Survival of the fittest. It's not my responsibility to look out for those around me. And that's the exact opposite of the message that Jesus preached. And then here's a fun little nugget. Rockefeller considered himself a religious man. Went to church every Sunday. Carnegie, a little bit different. This one's going to go by real quick. Again, very wealthy. His steel mill industries, that was tough work. And he worked people so long, they would start to make mistakes. And in Philadelphia, where his steel mill was, 20% of the deaths of all males happened in his factory in that city. One out of every five men that died in Philadelphia died working in his factory. But that wasn't enough. He wanted more profit. And he said, the only way to make more profit is to get more hours and less money. So he rewarded them in 1892 with a 30% pay reduction across the board. And they said, well, this isn't right. So they had a strike. And as a result of the strike, Carnegie's right-hand man, whose name was Frick, that was his last name, he hired a group called the Pinkertons to stop the strike. And they killed 16 people. As a result. So that's how they responded to men's plea saying, we can't make it like this. And he said, I don't care. That's not my responsibility. So as we see this increase of poverty, this is the increase in frustration. I mean, just reading these words, can't you feel just a little bit of frustration on the part of the people who are in need and worried about getting by? And it says, but it's true that there are poor and needy people in the land of plenty in which so many are heaping together such fabulous wealth. This is the attitude. He's talking about the attitude of wealthy people when they see these things. He says, isn't it their own fault if they can't get along comfortably? I mean, there's so much money to be made. Isn't the blame on them for not being able to do it? Thus the subject is regarded by many of the wealthy who in many instances were poor themselves. The wealthy and comfortable often find it difficult to realize the destitute of the poorest class, which is rapidly becoming more numerous. And in 2020, I started looking up stats. What's it like? What is it like now? Did you realize that as of 2020, about 40% of our workforce was making $25,000 or less? That really surprised me at the wealth gap. Obviously, we know that people aren't doing well. Jesus said the poor you'll always have with you. But I didn't realize that 40% of the working people in our nation made $25,000 or less. That stood out to me. The top 1% owns more wealth than the entire middle class, all 52% of the workforce. And on page 289, Brother Russell writes, "The night is so slowly but surely settling around hundreds and thousands of our people, the night of poverty and despair. They are conscious of its approach, but feel powerless to check its advance. Rents get higher and work cheaper every year, and what could we do about it?" said a laborer. On page 297, and we're almost through this section in case anybody's wondering, this is kind of a downer of a subject, so we don't want to spend too much time on it. We just want to understand that it's happening. It's happening when we don't even realize it could be happening right in front of our nose, and we want to understand the motives behind it. And so Brother Russell had such an interesting perspective to be able to discuss this topic because he himself was wealthy. He himself was motivated. This was a man that was moving from morning to night every day. And he went from wealthy to not so wealthy because he spent all his money in the service of the Lord. And so who better to discuss this topic than somebody who probably knew a little bit what it was like on both ends? He says the criminality is not so much in the heartless motive or the wanton destruction of happiness and life to achieve a selfish purpose. The squandering wealth. We've got a computer on over there. That's all right. No problem. Look, there'd be no harm in building a $700,000 stable like the Syracuse millionaire, or in placing $50,000 of service on a dinner table like a New York Astor, if money were as free as air and water. But you see, every dollar represents an average day's labor. So the $700,000, it represents the labor of 1,000 men for 2 years and 4 months. It also represents 700 lives. $1,000 would meet the cost of the first 10 years of a child. And the cost of the second 10 years would be fully repaid by his labor. So the fancy stable, therefore, represents the physical basis of 700 lives. And it's concerning to think that some people think them building a stable or having a $50,000 dinner is more important than some people being able to live. Samuel Gompers, he was the president of the American Federation of Labor. They asked him, why aren't people going to church as much? And he said, well, the church and the ministry, they're siding with the wealthy people because that's where the money is. And they kind of need that. He who fails to sympathize with the movement of labor, he who complacently or indifferently contemplates the awful results of present economic and social conditions is the opponent of the best interests of the human family. And again, Brother Russell quotes this. I really like it. It's on page 292. He says, however you want to explain to the poor that there's more help for them today than there ever was, they don't want that. It says, any self-respecting, intelligent citizen, it's not the alms that he wants. He wants a chance to honestly and decently earn his bread by the sweat of his face and with dignity and have the ability to maintain his family. They don't want handouts. They just want opportunity, and they want to be okay. Brother Russell transitions here and says, look, there's a lot to complain about with the rich, but you know, make no mistake, everyone's able and willing to criticize millionaires. In some cases, we fear the judgment might be too severe. We therefore urge that our readers do not think too uncharily of them. And there's two reasons for it. One, remember that they themselves are also under the control of the present system. They're under the influence of the adversary. They're not necessarily called for the high calling. Look, they have the same problem everybody else does. The other problem is, we're insinuating that if the roles were reversed, that poor people would do differently, and that's not the case. That if you took somebody poor right now and you made them rich, that they wouldn't do exactly the same thing, even having experienced it. So again, we're not here to blame one person. We're not here to walk away from this pointing fingers saying this is so-and-so's fault. We know whose fault it is. We know it's the adversary. We just want to understand what motivates people to do things, and we also want to make sure that in the kingdom, we understand a little bit about where they're coming from and what they've done. Leviticus 19:15 says, be fair. It doesn't matter who's on trial. Don't favor the rich person because he's rich. Don't favor the poor person because he's poor. Just be fair to everyone. And I think that's good feedback for us. Keep in mind that, again, our enemy, it's not flesh and blood. It is the spiritual forces of evil in this world. And I really like this quote. Brother Russell says, if love were the controlling motive in the hearts of all men, each would delight to do his part for the common welfare. And as a part of understanding sin, there was a really interesting study done about what causes this behavior. And it's more situational than you might realize. They did a study on monopoly. And I'm going to share the findings of the study with you because it's really interesting. But first, I have to tell you rule number one of monopoly. Before we get into the study, rule number one is do not play with that woman right over there. She looks nice, but she is a beast. 15 years we've been together. I haven't won a single time, not once. But as far as this study goes, what they did is they set up an intentionally rigged game with over 100 people, so over 50 games. And they had a designated rich person and a designated poor person, right? So the designated rich player, he got a couple of things. One, they got more money in the beginning of the game. They got double the money the other person did. They got double the money when they passed go, and they got to roll two dice instead of one. So they got double the turns. Okay? Within 15 minutes of this happening, they started to show both verbal and nonverbal displays of dominance over the other person. Think about that. This is a game of monopoly. It's been 12 minutes. And because you've got more money, because you're getting more money, because you're getting every advantage, they started to think that they were better than the other person. And they started acting aggressively. They started becoming rude and condescending towards the other person. Almost nobody attributed their winning to the game being rigged. When they asked him at the end of the study, hey, how did you win that game? They started talking about the specific moves they made. Nobody said, well, you gave me twice as much. They thought they were just a better player. So why is that important? I think it's so important. Advantage can creep up on us. When we're lucky, sometimes we're luckier than we realize. And as a human being, it's our tendency to actually start looking down on the person next to us because they're not doing as well. So, takeaway questions for yourself. Number one, don't think of yourself as better than anybody else. You're smarter, you're better looking, you've got more money, you've got a nicer car, you've beat somebody 25 times in a row in Monopoly. I see you. 1 Corinthians 4:7 tells us, what hast thou that you didn't receive? And if you didn't receive it, then why are you bragging about it? Or if you did receive it, why are you bragging about it? As if you didn't receive it as a gift, as if it was somewhat of your doing. You ever catch yourself saying about mainstream Christianity, I don't know how they believe that. How in the world could they think that way? Well, number one, if you don't know, ask them. If you're witnessing, you should know. And the second thing is, of course they don't understand. We're not smarter. We're not better. That's the wrong message. We've been given a gift. So it's a good time to ask, what are my most inward thoughts when I look at the others around me? Am I gentle? Am I loving? Am I sincere? Like the Morning Resolve told us, I will strive to be simple and sincere towards all. Am I susceptible to these judgmental thoughts myself based on my own situation? And the answer is yes, we all are. The question is how? What's the struggle that each of us go through as individuals? It's going to be different for everybody. And turn away from worldly thoughts of frustration and turn towards spiritual thoughts of peace and trust. So now that we've gone through this section on the rich and the poor, we're going to talk just briefly about labor, about industrial competition, about the giants in these days and beyond human power to regulate. And again, we're only going to spend a slide, maybe two, on each one of these sections. We're not going to dive in. It's just Brother Russell's perspective on what he saw, again, in 1897. And I think that we see these things building up more and more now. It's so interesting how we can read it and say, that's now. And it's 130 years later. So as we look at machinery playing a factor, again, if you own a business, there's a good chance that you are addicted to cheap labor in this world. Oh, goodness. If there's anything you can do to cut costs, that's the number one cost of any business out there. So it makes sense when they say we need to make a little bit more. We'll go to your biggest cost and try to reduce it. And what Brother Russell sees is, you know, in all through history, there's always been a mudsill class, is what he calls it. There's always been somebody at the very bottom doing the work that the people at the top really don't want to do. And they don't pay them enough for it. But what changes now is that it's literally true that modern machinery is a slave with hundreds times the productive power of human beings. The wonderful strides of science and innumerable devices of the inventive age are fast driving manual labor out of many industries. It's not that he says it's good or bad. He just says it's happening. And some people are going to get uncomfortable with it. On page 321, he says, out of 500 men, 499 have lost their jobs to machinery in the log sawing business. In the manufacture of paper, 95% of labor has been replaced. And in 1880, you see the growth of women entering the workforce. And so 2.4 million women in 1880, and then in 1890, 3.9 million women. And now at the time he writes this, he says in 1912, so you can tell this is where he went back and made some adjustments. But in 1912, it was over 10 million. And again, he's not saying this is good or bad. He's just saying now there's more people having to work, but there's less jobs to go around. So the competition grows more intense daily. And then when we come into international aspects, there's other countries that have much cheaper labor. Do we see that today? How many of you have called customer service lately and not been able to understand the person that you're talking to? Right? Now, again, it's good for those countries and those economies. Like, I'm so glad that they have the opportunity to make something. So I'm not saying it's good or it's bad. I'm not going to get into the conversation. We're just noticing that it's happening. And that, again, it will cause competition and it will cause some frustration, right? Some uncertainty. One of the problems, though, is the way that they had their labor in some of the other countries. They employ women as cheap competitors to male laborers. So they paid women less. So you saw in other countries, for example, which show the 35 spinneries give work to 16,000 women and only 5,000 men. Well, it's because they were only paying women 60% of what they were paying the men. So let's just hire more women. Again, how do I save labor? Little girls, 8 and 9 years of age, are forced to work from 9 to 12 hours. The law requires that these children be in school, and the teachers complain, but the officials close their eyes to it. When it talks about industrial interests, they're talking about empires expanding, and again, we know these things already. There were people like Britain that are going over the world at that time, and they're entering other countries and they're dominating those countries, not to bring to them a better style of living. They just wanted to secure their own trade. So, you know, think about that. They're sending men to other countries and saying, if they don't follow orders, just kill them and get them in line. And that way we can make more money. You think that causes some frustration in the world? Maybe a little. Giants in these days, this is a topic that has actually been talked about a few times. So, and I had no idea, but Brother Bill Gill gave a talk on this a week ago. It's on the Christian Resources app, just about this one topic. And Brother Bob Goodman gave a discourse on it a couple of years ago. And the thought is that as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. And in the days of Noah, there were Nephilim. There were giants, there were men, and man, they did whatever they wanted to. You couldn't stop them. And that was a problem. And so the thought here is that in these days, like the sons of Noah, there are also these giants that can do whatever they want, and we can't stop them. It says that at this time, all the small shops and stores were being crowded out by trusts and corporations. And it says the masses are in serious danger of injury at the hands of such giant corporations who have immensely more power and no consciences. Apparently, there was a slogan in that day that said, corporations have no souls. And I got to tell you, there are corporations today that do some wonderful things, right? So we're not here to say corporations are all bad. At least I'm not thinking that. But I am thinking about the impact they have on society. And there absolutely are some scenarios where when they do the wrong thing, you can't touch them. And you can blame the corporation, but you can't blame any of the individuals in the corporation. I mean, come on, it's not their fault. It's just how it is. Page 360, Brother Russell lists 139 combinations of companies and trusts to regulate production, fix prices, monopolize trade, and rob the people in defiance of the law. The conditions are universal, and they are beyond human power to regulate. This is on page 381. It's how he wraps up the chapter. He says, but will not good people take steps to prevent the crushing of their fellow creatures? Less favored or less intelligent, do they not see that the upper millstone is coming dangerously close to the lower one, and the masses who must pass between them in competition are feeling the pressure severely? And he says, will not generous hearts provide relief? And the answer is no. The majority who are favored, either by fortune or skill, they're so busy, taking care of their own stuff. They're making money, that they're diverting as much of the possible grist to their own stacks, they really don't even realize how bad it is for others. You see, I don't think that wealthy people look at poor people and say, I'm glad that you're poor. I don't think they look. Right? Every one of us has a day-to-day that we're going through. It's no different. Most people aren't driving around to say, who can I give money to on the streets? We do it when we see an opportunity, but that's not how we spend our time, and it's no different for the wealthy people. And so they settle down to the enjoyment of their own comforts and special privileges, for the time at least forget or ignore the troubles of their fellow man. And I think that's true. And again, we know whose fault it is. It's the adversary. So that ended. Again, he wrote it in 1897. He revised it in 1914. What's happened since then? Right? It's been over 100 years. There have been a few things that have happened, right? Here and there. So Revelation 11:15. I really think that the scriptures tell us about these last days, and they say some really interesting things. And if you look really hard at it and you look at some of the details, you see it. And I think it's fun. It's not fun to watch it happening, but it is fun to understand. So in Revelation 11:15, the seventh angel sounds, the trumpet is blown. The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord. The nations were angry. And it's time for our Lord to destroy them which destroy the earth. Who are those that destroy the earth? Take your pick. There will be lightnings and voices and thunderings and an earthquake and a great hail. What's hail represent? Truth. And we know that because in Isaiah 28:17, it says, the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies. So Brother Russell says these are hard-cutting truths. And in reprint 1095, it says, Christ's kingdom will break up every civil, social, religious system of tyranny and oppression, putting down all authority and power opposed to it. There will be sweeping moral reforms. Interesting. Now, the moral reforms that he's talking about may be moral reforms in the fullness of the kingdom when everybody is returning to Christ, but in the meantime, we are seeing some now. Reprint 1692, it says, Christ's ruling kingdom will first of all lay bare, cut, scrape the evils of selfish society down to the very bone. exposing depths of corruption never before realized. And we are seeing that today. Things are exposed. You can't get away with the same stuff today that you could 100 years ago. And I like that. So, since then, a couple of small incidents, World War I and World War II. Can you imagine being in World War II and thinking, this is it, this is the kingdom, it's here? Goodness sakes. 37 million people killed in World War I and over 60 million killed in World War II. That's happened since he wrote this. Revolutions. Over 125 revolutionary events in the 20th century. 33 more so far in this new century. We're pacing right now a little over 150 if it were to keep going to the end of the century. What about social justice? Is that a hot topic today? Do we see a lot of people getting riled up on one side or the other? Do we notice that a lot of people that have spoken up for the African Americans in our country have all been killed for doing it? My mom and I were talking a couple of days ago, and I said, can you think of any African American leader before 1970 that wasn't murdered? And we couldn't. Isn't that wild? David Duke has been preaching all kinds of nonsense for 40 years. He's doing fine. Think about this particular subject. Again, I'm just gonna say it, even though it may be a little touchy. It's true, so I can't shy away from saying it. If you're white, you don't get it. If you're white, you haven't had these things happen to you. And we have to acknowledge that. And take a look at it. You know, I remember people saying, well, they've been freed since 1865. And no, like the 13th Amendment gave the abolition of slavery. It passed the Senate in 1864. It passed the House of Representatives in 1865. 2 months later, they killed Abraham Lincoln for doing it. But by the end of 1865, Mississippi and South Carolina required black people to have written evidence of employment. Same year, right? Not white people, just African Americans. In South Carolina, a law prohibited black people from holding any occupation other than farmer or servant. Yeah, you're free, but we're going to tell you the only way that you can work is if you work in these two areas. And if you do something else, you have to pay us an additional tax of anywhere from $10 to $100. Same year, right? Jim Crow laws passed. They stuck around for 100 years until 1968. In the 15th Amendment in 1870, look at this. This is really interesting. They got the right to vote from the Constitutional Amendment in 1870, but 95 years later, they had to pass another law saying you can't discriminate against these folks and make up other laws to make voting for them so hard. That is, again, we don't understand that. We've never had that kind of treatment. Even a lot of African Americans today haven't had that kind of treatment, but I think that it shows just the exposing of corrupt behavior towards a certain demographic of people, and it's absolutely a part of the building frustration that in the end will result in the great day of trouble. In August 7th, 1930, in Marion, Indiana, I found that you could buy a postcard of a lynching. Now, I'm not saying that that's the only time you could do it. I said that's the last time that you could do it. But just to get a general sentiment, there were white supremacists that would buy postcards of lynchings for 40 or 50 years. Can you imagine that? What if the people lynched were your kids or your parents? And what do you think Jesus thought when he looked down and saw men doing this to one another? More fueling of the fire? Politics? I don't need to say anything else, do I? I think when everybody sees that word, it doesn't matter what side you're on. You see that word, and you're like, yeah, that's a problem. So concluding thoughts. 2 Peter 3:10, again, it says that the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. I love that English Standard Version translation. The works will be exposed. So, since we know that all these things are going to be dissolved, what sort of people should we be to live in lives of holiness and godliness? In other words, don't add to the fire. People are frustrated. People are scared. If you don't know what the plan is of the world, one of my coworkers I was talking to, actually, he's not my coworker exactly, he's our chief financial officer. And he said he talks to his son about it, about the world's going to end and there's going to be destruction and fire and flames. And I said, yeah, but after that, you get the good part. He says, well, I don't agree with that. I think it's just bad and it's going to get worse. And so I'm talking him through how it's going to be and how he can manage through it. I thought that sounded terrible, right? So people, again, they're scared. Don't add to the fire. Don't cause any frustration. As followers of Christ, and I have absolutely not been a good example of this in the past 10 years. It's just now that I'm starting to realize that I should absolutely not add any emotional force to this conversation. It is what it is. We're not to be a part of it. Have faith and concentrate in the kingdom. Understand why these things are happening, and don't let these things detour us from the peace of God, which is one of the greatest gifts that we've received. Focus on peace. Love others as Jesus loved us. Notice that last part. Not just love others. How did Jesus love us except unconditionally? Ephesians 5:16. Make the best use of time because the days are evil. Revelation 3:15. We have this warning of the church of Laodicea that we're not hot or cold, that we're lukewarm. And that's a problem in the eyes of God. So let's be hot. Spend your time in the service of the Lord. And if you're looking for any good ideas on how to do that, look at what our Indian brethren are doing. Our brothers and sisters in India, they've got classes all over the place. The biggest class they have right now I heard of is 350 brethren. That's pretty fantastic. But they are working for it. So they are making their own flyers and PowerPoint presentations. They get together as groups and they get these posters ready and then they go hang them around town. And then you're going to love this. They have a car with on the back of it a TV and a speaker coming out talking about the plan of God and telling them about their next public witness. They do 10 to 12 public witnesses a year in neighboring cities. And they get a lot of people. They've been contacted by the local authorities as well as the mainstream churches. Hey, please stop. And they're like, no. It's a wonderful work they're doing. They get an average of anywhere from 40 to 75 people in their public witnesses. They have a WhatsApp texting group so that as new people come in, if they hear it, they like it, they get their phone number. And then once a week, they have their meetings on Sundays that last until the early afternoon. They go home, they eat, they come back, and they have another meeting just for the new people. That's dedication. So, Isaiah 25. Again, these are great witnessing scriptures and they're great thoughts of comfort and peace. You've turned the city into a heap. I think that's the world as we see it today. It's become a heap. It'll never again be rebuilt. A strong people will glorify thee. A city of terrifying nations will fear thee. And in this mountain will Jehovah of hosts make unto all peoples a feast of fat things. He will destroy the covering that covereth all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. Everyone will know the truth. He swallowed up death forever and wiped away tears from their eyes. And it will be said in that day, lo, this is our God. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation. And may the Lord add his blessing.